Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, James Harris. James is a former London police officer, where he was a major crimes detective and was part of the London Bridge terrorist attack response team. He has shared his expertise as a university professor and as an investigative skills trainer. And I'm really happy to have him on the show today, not only to talk through his experiences, but his techniques. And what he has learned is both a practitioner in the field and a bit more of a researcher in his training role as well. Lots of great ideas to share here that go well beyond traditional investigative interviewing and apply to so many of our conversations, including the power of professional curiosity. I love that phrase. The critical role that context plays in all of our conversations, the ABCs of investigations, and techniques for achieving best evidence. And we can think of that as evidence in the investigation world, or we could even think about that as evidence or ground truth in many of our negotiation and business conversations as well. Really happy to share all of these ideas and techniques with you today. Thank you all for being here. And before we get started, we want to take a minute, of course, to thank our sponsors. Please head over to humantel.com. That's where you can explore and learn all the training and resources and education that HumanTel has available. For anyone who has wondered, how do I capture what somebody's likely thinking or feeling in the moment by registering emotional shifts when they happen? HumanTel.com is the place to go for their best-in-class, self-paced online training to develop just such a skill set. I've done it. I highly vouch for it. Please check it out at HumanTel.com. And while you're there, enter the code INCLUSIVE25 for 25% off all of their online training programs. For the professional interviewers who are listening, please head over to CertifiedInterviewer.com. where you can learn more about the International Association of Interviewers, all of their online networking and peer-to-peer communication opportunities, their online and in-person training and educational events, their legal updates, and so much more. That's also where you can learn about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. If you qualify, what it takes to qualify, how you can pass the exam, earn the designation, and what it could mean for you and your career moving forward. All of that and more at CertifiedInterviewer.com. And while you're online, please head over to INCLUSIVE.com. While you're there, you can learn more about the programs that our clients ask us to facilitate for them to teach their teams how to apply strategic and ethical observation and persuasion techniques to encourage people to build stronger relationships and share the everyday confessions across all of their daily conversations. That can be all found at INCLUSIVE.com. Thank you very much for taking the time to be here again this week. We truly appreciate it. And now, without further ado, James Harris. Hello, James. It is great to see you. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
That's okay. Yeah, it's really nice to meet you, Mike. Thanks a lot.
From all the way across the pond in England, I appreciate you coordinating the times, and I've really been looking forward to this conversation. So this is the first time we're officially meeting, but yes, having read some of your work and paying attention to what you do and who you work with, I know with your investigations background, there are specific kind of aspects of the interview and investigation process that are near and dear to your heart and you focus on when it comes to applying ethical and legal means to encourage people to share the truth during the investigations process. One of the things that I saw you talking about, which completely biased for me, I think is of critical importance for human beings everywhere, is developing an investigative mindset. So if it's cool with you, I'd love to start there. If you could please walk us through, what does it mean to you to develop and execute an investigative mindset?
Yeah, so it's a term that the police hear when you become an investigator or a detective. So it's a policing specific, well, it's a policing term, but it doesn't have to be. You could work in human resources, sort of dealing with grievances or, you know, loss prevention. So it's a universal concept, really. It could even apply to a teacher who's, you know, kids smashed a window at school and they're trying to work out who it is. It doesn't have to be specifically about policing or criminal investigation, but for me, the investigative mindset is something that you need to develop and you need to always be using. So to me, what it is, the best way to describe it is professional curiosity. So to always be questioning. So say, for example, you had an account from a witness, you know, to question, first of all, like, who is the witness? So don't just read what they are saying, but actually, who is the witness? What's their background? What's the context within that they gave this statement? Where were they at the time? Who are their associates? So it's all about, yeah, being curious about that. And there's a sort of a checklist that every police officer was always told in England, and it applies to everyone, but it was, I don't know if it made its way across the pond or it's just an English thing, but it was the ABCs of investigation. So it was assume nothing. So assume that nothing is what it is. Always be curious about it. So check its validity, its veracity. The second one's a bit cynical, but believe nobody. And I don't mean that in terms of, you know, if somebody says, "Oh, I've just been robbed," you go, "No, you weren't." But it's that curiosity again to sort of be open to what that person's saying, be open-minded, but the need to make sure that that is true. So has what this person has reported actually occurred in the way it has done? And the final one was always check everything. So if you assume nothing and you believe nobody, then you check everything. And that, again, is the last bit really of the investigative mindset, is that professional curiosity. And then it's to go, right, I've listened to what you've had to say, and actually I've got some questions. There are things that you might have said to me that actually I think, I'm not quite clear what Mike was saying there, or I wonder why that happened that particular way. And it is literally going through that door, that open door, and going, right, here's a question. And the problem we often have is that mindset's quite hard, because we have this sort of rule that most of us have in society where we don't want to get lots of information. So if I say to you, like, how was your holiday? I just want you to say it was okay. That's like the maximum quantity, we would call it. Like, that's all I want you to tell me. Whereas if I was to say to you, like, oh, Mike, like, tell me about your holiday, like, from your journey to the airport, like, what vehicle did you take? Like, how many doors did the car have? Like, we don't normally do that. So the investigative mindset is having that extra level of curiosity to say, oh, you said you went to the airport, but, like, how did you get there? Like, what route did you take? Was there any other people there? So it's just asking those what you could think are awkward questions, but really they are there for you to check everything. So, yeah, if you just remember, I think, always, like, the ABCs, that will help you develop that investigative mindset.
I love it, man. Thank you. We're 35 seconds into this conversation, and you've already given people something that I hope they're capturing right now. Really starting with that concept of professional curiosity, whether I think, in my bias completely here, but I feel like whether it is our time pressure, like, we have so many things to do and so many places to be, whether it is our responsibilities or just the pressure to get done, whatever it is we're doing, an investigation, we're hiring somebody, we're trying to close a deal with a client, finish a negotiation, whatever it is, the pressure to get it done. We end up prioritizing the conclusion over the process. And then we lack that professional curiosity. And those ABCs you mentioned, yeah, I mean, they might sound cynical to somebody who's just kind of checking in. Oh, yeah, well, don't believe anybody. Like, well, yeah. We don't mean that in a negative way. Like, I believe a lot of great investigators, the way you've illustrated, have developed the ability to accept what they hear without judging it as true or false, positive or negative. It's just, okay, this is what I've been told. Now, understanding what I've been told, and you mentioned it, in the context of the situation I'm trying to resolve, how do I use this to start executing that curiosity and get closer to what the truth is, good, bad, or indifferent, and how we can move on? And again, I think that was a great explanation, even with the victim. Just because somebody says I've been robbed doesn't mean we should say, no, you haven't. But it means that we should listen really closely to their account of being robbed, because there might be something else going on that they're not sharing with us. Yeah, maybe they didn't get robbed, but more than likely they did. But in how we listen to the account lets us ask better follow-up questions to gather better intelligence to resolve the crime that much quicker. And that's true to your point, whether it's a crime or whether somebody walks into an HR office and says, well, Michael said something inappropriate to me. It's that same investigative process.
Yeah.
How did you learn to develop that professional curiosity?
I think it comes through, I guess the best way to describe it is recognizing that it is awkward at times. And so like, just to follow what I was saying, and the best example is, you know, if somebody, a victim of a crime or a witness says, well, this is what I saw, this is what I heard, the best way to say is don't believe it as it has been presented. Like, believe the fact that they believe they have been a victim of a crime, but always be recognizing that, you know, there are impact factors that affect our recall, that affect the way we see things. So you need to be able to check it. And I want to believe you, like, I want to be able to go away and say, absolutely, this is what they saw and heard. And I know it is because I've gone away and I've tested it. And actually, that's the best way of looking at it, is the investigative mindset is to then have the confidence and the comfortability to say, I know this happened. So, or to say, I've looked into this and I cannot confirm or deny it did happen. Like, I'm unable to. And the investigative mindset will always help you, because later on, the reality is someone will ask you in any investigation, why did you do that? So investigations are all about decision-making. Why did you do that? Why did you not do that? And you do not want to be in that position later where you go, I don't know why I didn't do that. Or I do know I did that. Like, why didn't you go and ask those follow-up questions? Well, that was a bit awkward. So the development of the investigative mindset is that recognition that the actual uncomfortability will come later. It's far more awkward to be, you know, whether it's in a courtroom or an employment tribunal or, yeah, like in your boss's office while you're trying to explain why perhaps you didn't ask some questions about a deal that's ended up collapsing. I would rather have those uncomfortable conversations earlier on, so that when I am stood at those places later, I can say, well, I did test it, I did ask it. So I don't think everyone has it. I don't think everyone can develop it. I think you have to be willing to ask those questions, but you just always have to want to know why. And some people are comfortable not wanting to know why or how. They go, yeah, fine. But if you do want the investigative mindset, you will feel that nagging of, I don't know why. It nags me. I still don't know why. Or at least I know I've exhausted all opportunities to find out why, and I just can't. So yeah, that's where it comes from. And to develop it is, like I say, it's going to be a bit uncomfortable. Questioning people is uncomfortable. But what's more uncomfortable, that awkward question or trying to justify your actions later to people? That's what I would say.
I think that's a great point. Yeah, I'd much rather experience a little initial awkwardness now than have to. And I mean, hopefully none of our listeners, I'm assuming some of them will, but hopefully none of our listeners ever end up like testifying in a court. Like, that's a whole different ball of wax, yeah. Right? Some will, but a lot won't. But even if it's not standing in front of a judge, it could be, honestly, for me, sometimes my wife told me to take care of something and I thought I did and I made a mistake and she asked me about it. And it dawns on me that I was one question away from having this solved, but for whatever reason, I was busy, I was distracted, I didn't think it was important, I didn't ask. And now here I am going, oh, I guess I should have asked that question, which is especially embarrassing for me, by the way. So all great points. And I do feel like the key that you really hit on there was the willingness. If people have the willingness to develop the investigative mindset, it's there to be had. But if they don't, if for whatever reason, they don't think it's important enough, then just like anything else in life, they won't. And I feel like that professional curiosity, and I would love your thoughts on this, ties into listening to somebody, accepting what they have to say, like as neutral as possible. And then it almost becomes like a math problem. What doesn't add up? What's missing? What's the next question? How do I connect a dot to another dot? And then the professional curiosity extends not just to how we listen, but how we ask the questions. Because if we ask a question that's like, oh, you went to Heathrow? How'd you get there? You took the tube? Which one? Now all of a sudden people are like, oh, whoa, this guy doesn't believe me. But now if it's, oh, Heathrow on a Monday morning, man, I have never had a smooth trip to Heathrow, no matter how I got there. I'm curious, How did you try to get around the mess and get into that monster on a Monday morning? Now, just asking it in a curious way helps people divulge even more information. So I feel like it's important for the curiosity to cover both sides of the equation.
Yeah, definitely. And also, it's why are you having that conversation in the first place? Like, if you're not there to believe what you're being told, then or at least believe that they are telling you the truth, whether that's a witness or a suspect. But yeah, then how do you follow up? And then perhaps we'll go on to this, but it's recognizing the impact that your questions can have on people. And like I said, that doesn't have to be a policing context. It can be anything, but recognizing that, you know, somebody might say to you like, oh, so yeah, you went to Heathrow. How did you get there? Oh, I got the underground. Well, how long did that take? Oh, about 45 minutes. Well, I know it takes at least an hour on a good day to get to Heathrow, but that's recognizing, I then recognize that, well, actually, we're not very good with times and distances. People generally aren't very good at it. So I might want to follow that up with questions like, where did you get on? But I'm also really aware that actually human memory is very fallible. And, you know, if you said to me, like, how tall or how far away was that, even as an, you know, experienced in law, I'm not very good at that. So you shouldn't jump to go, well, clearly that was at least 20 feet and he said 10 feet. So that's a really important thing for an interview or anyone having a conversation to be aware of, is actually how difficult it is for people to recall things and recall very specific things. And actually not jump to the conclusion that they must be lying because they got a fact wrong. Like, they might have got the fact wrong because, yeah, I thought it was an hour, it was actually 45 minutes or vice versa. So that's where the investigative mindset comes in, because it's not a judgment. It's just, they said an hour, but I know it would take a lot longer than that. So I would like to go and explore that a bit more with them, not in a judgmental way, but just more of an inquiring way to say, look, maybe I can help you here because you thought it was an hour, but I'm telling you, if you got on a Paddington on a Monday morning, it would have taken longer than that. So can we just revisit that? And that's a clarification rather than a challenge. And that's important, I always think, of interviewing.
I'm pretty sure the last time I was at Paddington, it took me longer than 45 minutes to get from the staircase to the train,
let alone if the train even turns up. Yeah.
I want to get back to what you just mentioned, the impact our questions have on people. Take that. You had a trainer that used the word train again. Now I'm a nerd. But you obviously had a sequence of thought, let's say it that way, in regards to the impact that our questions have on people, which can be significant and we don't always realize it. So please dive into that a little bit further.
Yeah. So I think, you know, there's, if people want to go out and look at this up, there's such a wide range now of literature and research studies that have been done on the impact of questioning. And again, I take it back to that maxim of quantity I talked about earlier, that if I say to you, like, you know, how was your day? We usually ask our loved ones or our friends a very short series of closed questions. We'll say, how's work? Like, what time did you get there today? Like, oh, what did you have for lunch? Anything silly happen? And that's generally how far we go. Whereas the reality is that those types of questions, whilst they're not damaging, they restrict and they encourage people to only give very short, specific answers. So if I said to you, like, how was work, you know, anything happened at work today that was out of the ordinary, that's a very specific thing I'm asking you. Whereas you naturally then will think, well, I won't answer anything outside of that because that's the specific question I've been given. So we should, as interviewers or just people who want to find things out, recognize the open questions. So tell me what happened, explain what happened, describe the car. We're inviting people to give more information without sort of restricting only specific details. And I think that's really important for most people, but it's quite awkward. Like, you know, if your wife came home from work and you went, oh, describe your day for me, explain in as much detail like what happened at lunchtime, they're going to go, what? Like, that's not what we normally ask each other. So it when we talk about interviewing, it is a break from societal norms. It's not natural to ask these types of questions on a daily basis. And then the last thing to just sort of really highlight around question, like leading questions. So I always think it's quite ironic if you, you know, if anyone does have the misfortune to go to court, even the, you know, just to go as a public gallery, barristers and solicitors, that is exactly what they're trained to do. So isn't it right that you then went through the door? That's a leading question, isn't it? But the dangers of that in a non-legal setting or courtroom is that it invites the answer that the interviewer wants to get. You know, was it a red car? Well, that says to the person you're asking, the interviewer thinks it's a red car and they want me to confirm. Actually, I thought it was green, but the interviewer clearly knows more better than me. I naturally want to help them. Yeah, well, yeah, okay, it must have been red then. So, and that might not seem the end of the world to a lot of people, but especially more and more, you know, in terms of the justice system, vulnerable people, children, vulnerable adults, they have higher levels of suggestibility. So if we are using an innocent, you know, what we might think is quite an innocent question to somebody who is a higher level of suggestibility, which, you know, research now shows, that could really be damaging. So questioning is a huge part of any interviewer's tool belt. And actually, you want, in the absolute ideal world, to ask as very few questions as possible, because really, in the perfect world, I would say, Mike, tell me what happened. And you would just tell me everything and I wouldn't even need to follow it up. But the minute we start asking questions, it's like a forensic scientist going in to a crime scene, you know, and potentially you're going to start trampling on that memory, especially with witnesses. So you've got to be very careful about how, you know, a good question is like using good forensics, sort of avoiding cross-contamination. So, yeah, I always say to people, it seems so silly to think that a question can do a lot of damage, but it really can.
And do a huge amount of damage. And this goes well beyond the investigative realm. If you're looking at employee-manager relationships, business and business-to-business customer relationships, in negotiations, we end up steering somebody away from what otherwise could have been a more positive or constructive outcome. But I see this a lot with teachers. So, I mean, I have a young son and you know, he's gotten in a little bit of trouble over the last couple of years, and that's okay. His last name's Reddington. That's bound to happen. So I've fully come to grips with that. Not sure my wife has. I have. But when I hear some of the questions that they ask him, and then I hear the answer he gives, and then they get upset about the answer, I just want to call time out and be like, what did you expect the answer to that question was going to be? Like, right, wrong, or indifferent, how you ask a first grader a question is going to not just significantly, but potentially entirely impact how they answer it. And that's not just true, to your point, for first graders. Children, as they grow up, really for people to realize that as a figure of authority, the amount of unrecognized or unintentional influence we have over other people's thoughts, answers, behaviors can be significant.
Yeah. And that goes through to adulthood to a large degree. You know, like even as an adult, generally, we want to defer to positions of authority. We want to help positions of authority. And yet without, some people would abuse that and use that to their advantage. But even inadvertently, you could find yourself influencing somebody to say something really they didn't plan to say, but they're really trying to help you. And by asking a leading question, you might be leaking something that they didn't know, or you might be leaking the answer that they want you to give. You want them to give. And the last thing, just to return to sort of children as well, is, you know, we have a set of guidance here that our Ministry of Justice produces, always called Achieving Best Evidence. And it's a fantastic resource for anyone really in the world. But you know, it really stipulates the importance of establishing with children, in particular as well, the difference between truth and lies. Because, you know, what age does a child really start to recognize the difference? And, you know, so it's important when you're interviewing children to sort of go, not in a patronizing way, but just to really confirm to them that they do know the difference between an untruth and a truth. Because, yeah, they shouldn't just be presumed, oh, they're a 12-year-old kid, like they must know the difference now. Everyone develops cognitively in different ways. So, Yeah, it's really important. Yeah, my wife's a teacher, so with older kids, thankfully. But yeah, they probably ask questions every day. You know, kids misbehaving or not done their homework. Not in the class where they should be. So they're questioning people every day.
For sure. A couple of great points in there that I'd like to get back to, and I'm trying to remember to get to them in order. When you talk about asking that one question and letting them go, for me, my go-to is just please walk me through. And hopefully that sets up the expectation of detail and sequential order. And then to your point, I think the perfect opposite, now opposite is not the right word for it, but think about like two sides to a coin. It's curiosity and patience. So if you ask a question like, tell me about, walk me through, and then somebody starts and they're doing exactly what we want them to, and then we jump in with a question, now we start making all of the mistakes that you just started talking about and then some by knocking them off track. And now they're trying to satisfy us as opposed to tell the story. And then when we start getting those implied expected answers, you talked about like leaking out what the answer is, they give us what we wanted. We find out later that that's not the truth and we blame them for lying to us. Well, that's not how this works. We actually set them up to give us that answer. So whose fault is it now? So all tremendous points as you were going through that. Couple of things I'd like to ask, but the first one that I'll go back to is you talked about helping people understand the difference between telling a truth, and I love how you said it, telling an untruth, because an untruth can fall into any number of subcategories. And you're right, not only do we develop cognitively at different levels, but the context of how we are raised and developed can have an impact on our perspective of what's a truth or an untruth. But I like to focus on the truth side for a minute. I know one of the things that you do, which I'm very much intrigued by, is work to bridge the gap between science and practice. And I don't think enough people do that. A lot of people find themselves on one side or the other. They build a fence, they arm themselves, and they shoot nasty words and beliefs back and forth across the gap, when in reality, the best practices are quite likely somewhere in the middle. And if we could all just get along, we could create much better solutions. But based on you working both sides of that fence, in your experience, why do people choose to tell the truth potentially in the face of vulnerability and consequences?
Yeah, so I consider myself, it's such a buzzword, but like a pracademic. So yeah, like having been a practitioner working in my practice being policing, but then also now at the university. So, but I still deliver training on interviewing as well. So I hugely believe in the involvement of science and research, evidence-based to prove that things work. We should be using what works. And my last role in the police as an interview advisor, that was what I did. I would advise strategies around certain things, and it was always backed by science. So yeah, I'm a huge believer. So I think when you talk about why do people tell the truth, you could sort of look at it in different ways in terms of like why do people tell the truth, and then why do people perhaps admit to things like truthfully, like so truthfully admit to doing something wrong. And I guess the first place is just that obvious. Some people have guilt, the internal, so what they would call like the internal pressure, actually it's rising that, as I hear more and then the interviewer is speaking to me, the guilt just keeps rising. It keeps rising. And actually I can't cope with that guilt, or I can't cope not telling the truth. So I'm being asked, did you see this? Or, was Mike at home last night? He's told us that you told him he was there. I'm making a decision whether I should tell the truth or not. Actually, for me, the uncomfortability or the guilt would come from not saying no, actually, the truth. So I think that's always one reason why people tell the truth. I think the second reason, again, these are sort of research-based, they're not necessarily my own ideas, but I've seen them in practice, is that perhaps people don't feel that level of guilt, but they probably think, well, actually, I don't plan to tell the truth, but actually, because of the setting in which I'm being questioned in, actually, that's quite pressurizing. So I don't feel guilty about that old lady I stole a bag off. I don't feel guilty about that, but the level of questioning or the intensity of the scenario and perhaps the consequences, that's now ramping up. And actually, as a result of that pressure, I think, you know what, it's just easier to tell the truth. Okay, yeah, fine, you've got me. I'll tell the truth. And I think other people, and again, sort of taking it from the literature, but I've seen it again, it's a cost-benefit analysis, isn't it? It's what's the benefit of telling the truth? What's the benefit of telling an untruth? What's the benefit of keeping my mouth shut and saying nothing at all? You know, like if we go to the absolute nth degree, like a murder suspect, you know, and I've had the misfortune to interview some murder suspects, you know, why would I, if I admit this, what's the consequence going to be? Well, I'm guaranteed to get a life sentence. So there's no point me saying anything. I might as well wait and see what the police have got on me. And if I get found guilty at court anyway, I'm going to go to prison for life. So there's no benefit. But some people might think, well, I'll tell a truth because if I tell the truth now, the benefit being actually it will look good. It will look good. I've held my hands up straight away. I'll be seen to be being helpful. And actually, therefore, if I have done something wrong, the consequences are going to be perhaps less if I try and lie and lie and lie and then I get found out. So I think broadly, they're the sort of three reasons. And then, like I said, I've taken them from a lot of the literature in terms of names, but my own experience coming into practice, not just in policing sort of models, but also other lines, is that that's what people do. They either feel that immediate guilt or that immediate need to persist. They either sort of hold out and hope that perhaps they can get away with it, but ultimately that pressure is too high, or they're actual like, rational decision makers and go, right, what's the benefits of lying? What's the benefits of not? And then they make an informed decision.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it. And I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, see if I can streamline my thoughts here. But you know, on one hand, you've got like the emotional reason. Either I feel guilty or I've got this pressure and okay, fine. And on the other side, you've got the rational. And the rational could be that cost-benefit analysis, or it could be, well, you know, I'm just doing the math here and it sounds like they know. So if the truth is known, I may as well try to put my spin on it. I may as well try to save some face here and feel better and talk through. Especially with your research. And I know the standard operating procedures and some of the laws and rules are a little bit different on your side of the Atlantic than our side of the Atlantic. But I feel like when interviewers get themselves in trouble, it is because they're focusing too hard on that emotional side. I'm really trying to ramp up that pressure to break them, or I'm really trying to ramp up that guilt to break them. And there's this whole other potential side of the coin that could be a productive path to the truth. If I'm wrong from what you've seen, correct me. You're not going to hurt my feelings. But where we've seen police officers cross the line, maybe force false confessions, or even if they don't get a confession at all, just create more barriers for themselves that they didn't necessarily need to. And it doesn't have to be police officers. I shouldn't have said it that way. Investigators in all contexts.
Yeah.
Through your experience as a pracademic, do you think a lot of it comes down to that focus on trying to, you know, break somebody emotionally or pull that emotional lever? Or are there other areas that I'm missing that could lead to that?
Yeah, good question. So I think where that comes from is recognizing that if we're talking about any sort of investigation, whether it's criminal or it's a teacher doing an investigation, like I say, to find out who broke the window at school, it's recognizing that an interview of any sort is actually just one cog in the wheel of an investigation. And what I think, I haven't done a lot of research, and I've done much research at all, to be honest. It's mainly my academic experience, but my practitioner experience, sorry. But it's, I think over here, because of what's happened in the past, and we do have a check at history in the UK of false confessions and oppressive interviewing and policing. And yeah, we have very strict laws now that govern how those interviews are conducted. But I think it's recognizing, like I say, this interview is part of the investigation. And ultimately, what is going to prove or disprove the allegation, whatever it is, like I say, whether it's a criminal matter or a workplace matter, is ultimately going to be the facts. It's going to be the evidence. And that's what I would rely on. So when I was a police officer, the interviews weren't really the most important part of an investigation. We would rely more on, like, have we got, you know, witness testimony, CCTV, forensics, that's what's going to prove or disprove what really happened. And I think those people who go too far, they see the interview as like, I need a confession, because the confession is the gold standard. If I secure a confession, then actually this matter, whatever it is, can be resolved a lot quicker. And that is not to say that confession shouldn't be seen as important. I believe it is, and there's lots of reasons why confessions are important. They reduce the time of the investigation, the costs. They get things done quicker for the victim, etc. The suspect might get benefits. But it's when you start thinking, I have to get a confession. And so that's when people tend to go that extra line. And I think it doesn't happen here really anymore because of our laws, because of our legislation, because of our codes, because all interviews are, I mean, police stations are recorded from a policing perspective. But yeah, I've got no idea, like, you know, a HR interview or a workplace investigation that might not be recorded. It could still happen. But yeah, I think it's that recognition of, I need to get a confession. This person must be guilty, and an assumption of guilt has been made based on something. So it might be based on the fact they were really nervous when they came to the police station, or they came to the interview in the HR office. And once you've got that mindset, that tunnel vision, so rather than the investigative mindset, you've now got that tunnel vision. This person in front of me did this. They did make those comments in the canteen. I've got three people who said they said it. So I need you just to admit it, because it'll be much easier. And that's when we can ramp it up. And that's where a good ethical interviewer understands what can happen. Like, so the dangers of going too far. But I do believe here, at least, that doesn't happen in a law enforcement setting, because we've moved away from that because of these sort of a very checkered history that we did have sort of pre-1992.
And we have some of that here in the United States as well. And when I say some of that, depending on somebody's background, they might go, oh, really, some? And others might say, well, hang on. But we've got some of that as well. And I think you hit a couple of nails right on the head, prioritizing the confession, making it a win-lose conversation, determining somebody's guilt before the conversation starts. And that is true for parents. That is true for teachers. That is true for supervisors. That is true for law enforcement. It's true across the board. Anytime we start making this a win-lose conversation and presume somebody's, I'll just say, designation, guilty, innocent, responsible, irresponsible, whatever it is, you know, we're setting ourselves up for failure right there out of the gate. So certainly agree with that.
Yeah.
I lost one of the follow-up questions I was going to ask, so it will come back to me, I promise. But earlier you talked about achieving best evidence. And even here, you just mentioned the importance of evidence. And I'm going to come back to this, but before I forget again, I wanted to reinforce your point. So I learned this lesson the hard way early in my career as an investigator. I was working a theft case, and they had CCTV footage of electronic equipment that came up stolen, being moved from a place it wasn't supposed to begin with, off camera, out of the way. So it looked, for all reasonable people, the person who staged it here came back and picked it up later and walked off camera with it, statistically speaking, is the person that stole it, right? So it wasn't supposed to be there. He put it there. He came back and got it. It's gone, whatever. So I sit down to interview this guy, and I'm very early in my career at this point. And yes, I've made up my mind that statistically speaking, this has to be the guy that took it. And then on top of that, because we know it's gone, but we don't know where it went, I've now told myself, I've got to get this guy to confess, because I don't have the evidence for the end result of the equipment. I should probably tell you, and I don't want to exaggerate, at the very smallest, this guy was about 6'4" tall, and he was likely bigger than that. I just don't want to exaggerate.
Same as me. But
he's a big dude. So I'm interviewing him, sitting 4 feet in front of him, nothing in between us. We're having a reasonable conversation. I start accusing him of the theft. He starts getting upset. And I've been taught that if people get more and more upset, that could be an indication of potential innocence. Time to start backing up. Nope. I got my bulldog face on. This has to be the guy. He finally stands up and points down at me. So I'm sitting, and this dude, who conservatively is 6'4" tall, points down at me and he yells, I didn't steal that equipment. And at that point, Thankfully, I was smart enough to look at him and say, well, thank you. I appreciate you making that clear. And I just gestured back to the seat and he sat down. And I'm not going to lie. At that point, like, I was just thankful that my head hadn't been caved in, let alone that he hadn't walked out. And this is more a credit to him than it is me, because this was very early in my career. He stayed engaged in the conversation, ended up giving me some information that I was able to generate a secondary suspect with. And in another interview about 2 weeks later, not only did that guy admit to taking this stuff, but a bunch of other stuff, and brought most of it back. The stuff that he hadn't sold yet, he brought back. So that's a mistake that it could have cost me my job. It could have cost me my jaw structure. Like, it could have cost me lots of things very, very early in my career, to illustrate your point. But now to get back to the question, what are some techniques that you've seen for achieving best evidence, especially through conversation? Because sometimes getting the, to your point, getting the confession isn't nearly as important as getting details that can lead to new evidence, corroborate evidence, or discredit evidence, depending on the situation.
So just to finish that and then sort of lead into this is, I always say, like, if you're interviewing somebody, like a suspect or somebody accused of wrongdoing, like, why, if you know they did it, like, there's overwhelming evidence, why do you need them to admit it? Like, if the evidence is really strong, so, like, if you've got a workplace investigation and, like I say, it happened in the staff canteen and there's CCTV footage of it, you've got four members of staff who saw it and have given statements and are all of good character. If you ask, I approach the suspect, welcome them to an interview, I speak to them, ask them in a non-judgmental way, this is what the allegations are against you. Like, in your words, tell me what happened. So they then can tell me whatever they like, their truth, their version of events. If that doesn't marry up to what I've already got, so I've got the CCTV, I've got the statements, I can just say to them, like, look, there's an issue because all these things that you're saying, they don't marry up to this. Why are they different? And I don't need to do that in an accusatory, judgmental way. I can simply say, you said this, the evidence says that, why are they different? And if at the end of it, despite being shown their inconsistencies, they still want to maintain their position of innocence, well, fine. Like, because the evidence is strong, we'll go away. And my job, that investigative mindset, is to go away and go, here's the facts, look what happened, on the balance of probabilities or beyond reasonable doubt, I think they did it. So that's where I think people just, the confession doesn't need, I don't need the confession. I think people do it when they're desperate, when there's a lack of other evidence. Just to go on about what works. Well, like I said, I've interviewed some people for horrific crimes, and I think this word rapport is a really important word. And what does it mean? Well, there's so many different definitions of rapport and different techniques, but the way I always think a good place to start, and it doesn't matter, like I say, what workplace or field you're in, is empathy. And I don't mean empathy in sort of like, I'm sorry to hear that, but empathy, like putting myself in that person's shoes. Like, how does that person see the world? So, like, they might have done something that I fundamentally disagree with, or like is so reprehensible. But if I was sat in their shoes right now, what might I be feeling? How do they see the world? Do they see people in positions of authority as non-respectable? And I think once you start to do that, you can then give them, like, it's a big part of motivational interviewing and etc., of that autonomy, giving them the freedom to engage in the process. Say, look, the evidence does seem to suggest that it's inconsistent with your account, but I'm not going to force you. I'm not going to apply sort of coercive and oppressive methods to get you to confess. In your own time, I'd like you to realise the situation that you are in. So I think that's a really big thing, being honest and respectful. Any rapport that you build has got to be sincere. So you're never going to be this person's friend, and you shouldn't be, because remember, you're that objective person, you're there to find out the facts. But being sincere, and I mean, look, I actually want to hear what you've got to say. Trying to remove the barriers. So Like, what's your brand? Like, if I'm going in as an interviewer, I'm a grievance investigator. Well, that title just sounds oppressive, doesn't it? Like, but look, hi, my name's James. I've been sent by HR. I've been asked to speak to you today about these allegations that have been made. And that straight away, like, personalizes it a little bit. And just, and then people start looking at you more as, oh, James sincerely wants to hear what I've got to say. And you know what? I do sincerely want to hear what you've got to say, because my job is to talk to all different people in this case. So I think that's really important. And rapport is easier said than done. But I do think no matter what you're dealing with, you can build that with the person that you're speaking to. And the last thing really I would say on sort of specific techniques is that they don't all apply to the same thing. If you go in with like a tick list of like, oh, this worked last time, you've got to actually listen to the person that you're with. So like any conversation, like, what is this person? What are they saying? How are they responding? How does it come across that they're feeling? When I mention this, do they seem to react differently to perhaps when I talk about another subject? So really, really importantly, I think the biggest word to summarize that is sincerity, is just genuinely being interested to hear what that person has to say. And again, that comes back to professional curiosity, doesn't it? Because you want to find out.
What a great tie back. Well done. That sincerity and rapport is critical. If we are having a conversation with anyone in any context, business, family, investigative, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And there is any motivation to initially distrust us,
yeah,
that person is looking for a reason to justify their distrust. Yeah. So if we're trying to establish rapport in a way that comes off as insincere, there it is. You are already trying to manipulate me before the real point of this conversation has even started. You are officially untrustworthy.
Exactly.
And I'm sure you have as well, but I've seen way too many investigators and sales professionals and even leaders in a candidate, people who are interviewing candidates for jobs, and the reverse, candidates, people applying for jobs, who during the rapport building process made an effort to be somebody that they're not in order to be liked more. And in that situation, the two most likely outcomes are either your insincerity, excuse me, shows through and this whole thing falls apart, or you fool them today, but then they figure it out later, yeah, which could be an even bigger problem. So that sincerity piece is so critical.
Yeah. And if you say something like, I'm here to listen, you know, and then that, cause that, that's part of the rapport building process. Like, I'm here to listen. And then 5 minutes in, you're sort of like, oh, so just, you know, summarize, and then you summarize it completely wrong. Well, you haven't done what you said you were going to do. And then straight away, that person's going to go, don't really want to talk to you, because you asked me at the beginning to tell you, you know, be open with you, to give you all this information. You're not listening, are you? And as soon as we feel that, you know, we all, you know, family members or anyone, if you don't feel someone's listening to you, you don't want to talk to them. You think, because there's no point. And then also that might form a judgment. Well, then they're not listening to me, because they've already decided, they've already made their mind up. So what's the point of carrying on talking to them? They clearly have already got something in their mind. And I always give this example to students and training environments. You know, if you go to interview somebody and, you know, for a crime, or, you know, something in the workplace or family, whatever, but you don't like it, and they, it's a complete stranger, you know, and they stick out their hand and you go, I'm not shaking, you know, you don't verbally say it, but you refuse to shake the hand. But what does that say to that person? Well, it says to that person, well, they've already made their mind up. They're not shaking my hands. They've already got an opinion on me. So then when you then go into the interview room or wherever, and you go, like, oh, I'm here to hear your version of events. I'm, you know, I'm impartial. You know, you didn't want to shake my hand, did you? So that gesture, and I'm not saying everyone has to shake people's hands, but being aware, that emotional awareness to go, do you know what? If I shake somebody's hands, that doesn't mean I condone, you know, if I'm investigating child abuse and I shake the hands of a child abuse suspect, that doesn't mean I condone child abuse. It just means I've shaken the hand with somebody, and actually I shake the hands of everyone I meet. And that's just a general form of interaction. And actually, you know, the principles of reciprocity, shaking somebody's hand, even something small like that, you get something in return. Would you like a cup of tea? Would you like a coffee? If they offered you a drink, getting them a glass, you know, again, those small acts might just mean they might not go, okay, yeah, fair play, like I'm going to confess to the whole crime because you got me a can of Pepsi. But they might tell you something they didn't plan to tell you, or they might deny the whole offence or allegation. But at the end of it, they might tell you a piece of information that perhaps you want to be aware of. So you're just being aware, I think, it's that a real awareness is part of this sort of intelligence that a good interviewer, no matter what field you're in, you need.
Couldn't agree more. And even with that, although I must confess that in this now post-COVID world, between right. the handshake and the fist bump, I get tripped up all the time and end up embarrassing myself. But I'm a huge believer in shaking everybody's hand for lots of reasons. But one of them, especially for the purpose of this conversation, is showing somebody individual respect. So to your point, you're a child abuser. There's lots of things I would love to be able to do to you right now. But I have a job. And my job, to, I believe, summarize a lot of what we've talked about today, is to document as many facts and details as possible, assuming this abuse did actually occur, in order to put this suspect in a position to have that punishment adjudicated or the consequences put upon them or whatever it is. We serve a role in the process. We are a tool in the toolbox to put the whole thing through.
Yeah.
It's shaking their hand and showing them that respect at the end, at the beginning of the conversation and at the end, but especially at the beginning of the conversation, helps change the tone of the entire interaction. We might be the first person that treated them with respect, and who knows how long. Now, to your point, reciprocity, their ability to open up is much greater.
I think just to finish on that, is that again comes back to, what is your role? Like, so I believe, and I always have, and perhaps maybe because of the justice system I operated in, of my role is not to form judgment. My role is not to determine guilt. My role is to try and ascertain the facts there is a wheel of the investigation. One of those cogs is the accused person's perspective. This is what they have got to say. And they've got a right to be heard, and they've got a right to refute the allegations, and they don't have to accept it. That's fine. Like, that's your, or you know, the autonomy that you have to not do that. And you know what? All I want to do is ensure that all of these cogs have been ticked. Okay. And then if there is sufficient evidence or that proves or disproves that you did it, well, then how that was captured was ethical, it was lawful, and it's for other people to determine your guilt. It's not my job to determine your guilt. And that's where I think interviewers, in some of these stories we can probably in history, where they try and get that confession, it's probably a lot of the time because they believe so passionately in what's gone on is so wrong. And it's like, I can't sit here and listen to you deny it. It sickens me that you're denying this. So they want them to confess. And the reality is that if we believe in the justice system, if we believe in a fair and independent system, that will come out anyway if that person is guilty. But what if they're not guilty? What if they didn't do it? Are you comfortable doing that? And then I would never be. So, yeah.
I agree totally. Independent fact finder was the phrase we used to use a lot. And there's a potential beautiful moments in conversations where people do start vociferously denying whatever the accusation is. And again, it could be minor, who broke the window or who didn't send the email or who said something they shouldn't have to who took somebody else's life. I mean, it can run the whole gamut. But in that scenario, maybe they really didn't do it. Maybe I got the wrong guy. That happens. Maybe what we thought was evidence pointed in the wrong direction, or somebody made an assumption, or whatever it is. So now if we apply that professional curiosity to the denials, it can lead us down a road that either confirms or gets us closer to this isn't the person, or they're not responsible, or it leads us to details that can help us turn around and prove that it actually is the person. So their denials end up actually becoming the facts or the anti-facts, if that's a proper way to say it, that help us solve the case. And for me, some of my favorite non-confessions have been from people who were adamantly denying it. I'm like, okay, cool. Walk us through. And they end up giving us such crisp, clean detail that very clearly violate what the evidence says. Like, in a planet with the scientific laws that govern how our Earth works, this is physically impossible. And so they save face, they feel good. But at the same time, we collected the facts in the manner that we needed in order for the proper conclusion or outcome to take place. There's multiple routes.
Yeah, and also like that doesn't mean you need to give, help the person. So the way I always explain it is, in my view, is that if I'm innocent of a crime, I don't need the police to tell me the evidence that they've gathered, because I'll tell you why I'm innocent. So if I wasn't at a location if I wasn't in, the locker room in the gym when they're accusing me of stealing, watches or something, I'll tell you where I was. I don't need you to tell me other bits of evidence. So there's no need for the police. This is what part of my role as like an interview advisor was, to sort of think strategically and say, like, right, we've got this murder weapon, say, like it's got the suspect's DNA and fingerprints on it. I don't need this person I'm interviewing straight away. I'm not going to lie, never lie, because it's against the law here to do that for the interviewers. But I don't need to tell that suspect that exists straight away, because if they've never touched it, they should just be able to tell me that. They don't need me to go, well, look, your fingerprints and DNA are on there, so did you touch it? So that's, whilst I say, yeah, you're absolutely the impartial, but there is a way of strategically using evidence to tackle and challenge people without impeding their rights and sort of being oppressive.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the strategic advisor role a couple of times, and I meant to ask earlier, so I'm glad you brought it up, and maybe we can kind of work towards wrapping up our conversation with this. And in fairness, I didn't ask you this in advance, so if you don't have something off the top of your head, don't worry about it. To me, the role of strategic advisor is always fascinating and fun. Always is a strong word. It's often fascinating and fun, because we get to look at an investigation or a situation from a little bit of an omniscient perspective and start trying to figure out how we can align the pieces on the board, sometimes in unexpected ways. And I don't know about your experience, but for me, often coming in from the outside, I run into initial resistance. Like, that's not how we were going to do it. That's not how we want to do it. Yeah. So I'm curious, off the top of your head, is there an example, in only the details that you can share, yeah, and a lot of it has to be confidential, is there an example that you can recall where, using your ethical principles, you looked at a situation, came up with a strategy that maybe was met with some initial resistance, and then created a positive result once it was put into action?
So the interview advisor role here was two strands. You would provide strategic advice on interviews with suspects of crime, but also like witnesses. So witness strategies, like what if I've got 150 possible witnesses, like how do I possibly deal with this? And a good example I'll give, like I won't go into specific details of the crime and stuff, but I had a case where I was called in relation to a large-scale fraud. And sort of like, you were brought in as the advisor, so your decisions don't actually carry weight. The senior investigating officer will have to ratify them, but so it's literally advice. And I was asked to come in on this case. They were planning interviews with the victims in the case. And we have quite strict laws here about particular witnesses who fall into certain categories, such as vulnerable or intimidated, and it could be because of their a physical disability, a mental disability, learning disability, etc. So that means they are afforded extra protection, and how we interview them on a video and various things. So I was asked to review the initial accounts and then provide an advice around how to actually then capture their evidence formally. And it became quite apparent early on that essentially they just wanted me to ratify what they'd already done. And I started to read these initial accounts, and, you know, some of the victims, like, I think fraud is it sounds a sort of dull crime, but the impact of fraud is tremendous, like in terms of impact. And, you know, people giving away large sums of money, you know, because of trust, they trusted somebody. And when you're reading these accounts, like some of the descriptions that people had given, you know, placed them very clearly, in my opinion, as an advisor in a clinically vulnerable, so clinically, I'm not a doctor, but in a vulnerable category. So my advice said, like, right, you know, witness A, B, C, because of what they said here, they are, under the law, in my opinion, a vulnerable witness. They therefore need to be interviewed in this particular way. And yeah, like I remember submitting it, and you know, this would require specially trained officers, you know, with knowledge of trauma. Yeah, like I got sort of called in. It was like, yeah, this sounds like a lot of work, what you're asking us to do here. And I'm like, well, yeah, but it's the right way to do it. It's the evidence-based way to do it, and it's consistent actually with the legislation. And like, I wouldn't say I was like cajoled, but you know, it was very much, could you change that? Could you change this? It's like, no, I'm not changing my advice. If you want to do something different, crack on. But this is how I'm doing it. And yeah, like some of the interviewers, like I was getting feedback, like, can't believe we're having to do this. Like, they're not really vulnerable. And it's like, yeah, okay. So yeah, that example always sticks out in my mind, that you've got this like strategic interview advisor who, well, yeah, he's an expert in their field. Like, and the way I looked at it was, if your forensics manager came up to you and said, right, here's the crime scene, this is how I would capture this, there's no way like the officers would go, oh no, we're not going to do it like that. You know, they're always going to defer to the forensic manager's advice. So why wouldn't you do it for the interview advisor who is the same for their field? So yeah, that just comes back though, really, just to finish, like, what's easier? What's easier for the, you know, that sounds like hard work. Well, yeah, do you know what? We do loads of these. We're used to it. But for that one person, that witness, that might be the only time they ever come into contact with the justice system or grievance. Or, let's make it as easy for them as possible. And actually, therefore, they give their best, not only do they give their best evidence, but they're left with a positive experience. So then they share that. And if somebody else comes along and says, oh, yeah, I've got to go and speak to HR, they can say, well, yeah, actually, they treated me pretty well. This is how they did it. So, yeah, never downplay the consequences of what your actions could do. It's a bit of a cliche, but it's so relevant.
That's a phenomenal statement, and I couldn't agree more. And it's something hidden in there that I don't know if people caught, whether it's in a formal investigation or just somebody stops by your office or whatever it is. This is likely a unique emotional moment for the person we're speaking with. It could be, you know, Tuesday for us, but yeah, it's a unique emotional moment for them. And we have the opportunity to turn this into a positive anchor or a negative anchor for them. And then not only for them, but for their network and their people. And my former teammates and I, we get laughed at when we say this, but we used to use, they still do, investigations as a morale boosting tool. Is we would get called into these organizations with these stale investigations that everybody is upset about. So if you treat people the right way, you can actually go in and use investigative interviews and even an interrogation if you have to, in order to boost morale and make people feel better about how it was handled. So that was awesome, man.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah. Just lastly, just the not just for you, but the reputation of your organization, like, beyond as well. So don't just think about that investigation, but think about, yeah, do you know what, actually that workplace, when an allegation gets made, god, they like really treat you really badly, they're really accusatory, or if you're a witness, they don't believe you, or I don't really want to go and work there then. Whereas, like, yeah, if it's an open, fair process, it's like, yeah, do you know what, actually I had a false allegation made against me of bullying at work, but the guy who interviewed me, really non-judgmental, asked loads of questions, you know, really probed me, asked some difficult questions. But actually, when I look at the investigation, it was done fair, transparency. And yeah, I didn't enjoy it, but I can't complain about it. Yeah. So yeah, that's always important to think of as well.
I love it, man. I can't thank you enough for taking the time today to share all of your thoughts, your insights, your stories, your experience. Thank you for people who would love to connect with you, learn more from you, experience your training if they're over there with you, or even just track your research and your posts, what are the best ways for people to connect and stay up to date with what you're doing and how they can learn from you?
Yeah, so I'm on LinkedIn, just James Harris, and I can share the link if you want to. Don't mind. Yeah, I'm always happy to connect with people. So training wise, yeah, I do that externally to my main role at the university. So they're two separate things, but yeah, always happy to chat, give advice. Really happy to, and yeah, like my research is only really just beginning. I haven't started that journey yet, but I'm still more of a practitioner background, but yeah, certainly going forward, that's a journey I want to go on. So as I do, yeah, if you stay on LinkedIn, I'll keep you updated as and when it starts.
No, I'm fascinated to watch and to learn from a man. I really appreciate it.
Oh no, really enjoyed being here, and thank you for having me on.
Oh, my pleasure completely. Stay safe over there, and hopefully we'll find a way to cross paths in person soon.
Absolutely, Mike. Yeah, take care. All the best.
James, thank you so much for such a great conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time to join us all the way from London. And thank you for all of the insights, ideas, research, techniques that you shared with us. I really appreciate it. And I love how you demonstrated how it goes well beyond just investigative interviewing, but applies to candidate interviewing, our business conversations, and beyond. Thank you very much for sharing all that you did with us today. I hope everybody listening along took notes and learned right on site us. I really appreciate it. And just to call a few things out, I really appreciated how you shared your definition of empathy. How you talked about the power of developing rapport was super important. As we think about the impact our questions have on people, what they say, how they respond, even what they believe to be true, that's so important for us to stop and think, and ties right into how you talked about why people will choose to tell us the truth or not. I really appreciate you sharing all that you did, James. Thank you. And thank you to everyone who listened and learned along with us. I appreciate you being here. So before we head out, let's just thank our sponsors one more time real quick. HumanTel. Please head over to humantel.com and enter the code INCLUSIVE25 for 25% off their online best-in-class training to begin to develop the skills to identify when people's emotions are changing right away in real time and what that indicates they're likely thinking or feeling in the context of the conversation. And then what can you do with that to help foster stronger relationships and achieve your goals? Learn all of that and more at humantel.com. For the professional interviewers, please check out certifiedinterviewer.com for the International Association of Interviewers. That's where you can learn more about their networking opportunities, their online and in-person training, all of their legal and investigative resources. And of course, that's where you can find out more about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. What does it take to qualify? How do you earn the designation? And what can it mean for your career going forward? All of that and more at certifiedinterviewer.com. And of course, while you're online, please head over to inclusive.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to facilitate for them when they want us to work with their leadership teams, sales teams, HR teams, and beyond to teach them how to apply the strategic and ethical observation and persuasion skills necessary to forge stronger relationships and encourage people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances and in the face of potential consequences. All that and more can be found at inclusive.com. Thank you all again for being here. Please, while you're here, take a second to like the show, subscribe to the show, share it, tell your network about it, and please leave your feedback. Who would you like to see? What would you like to hear more of? Honestly, what would you like to hear less of? We'd love to hear that too. We thank you so much for being here, and we really appreciate you helping us build the show and taking the time to share your feedback as well. Thank you so much. Please stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.